Chapter 12. Cynical Optimism. 1999 through 2005. At the time of the release of Episode 1 in May 1999, Lucas had been writing the script for Episode 2 for nearly a year. He was struggling with this one more than others, mainly because the second film would largely be a love story, driven by character and dialogue, neither of which was Lucas's strong suit. By his own estimate, it would take 14 or 15 drafts before he was comfortable enough with it to pass his handwritten pages over to his assistant to type. At the center of the title page, dated March 13, 2000, Lucas had scrawled Episode 2, Jar Jar's Great Adventure. The title was a joke, Lucas's way of making the point that he had taken to heart one of the key criticisms of The Phantom Menace. For Episode 2, Binks would be relegated to a minor supporting role, and any larger plans Lucas had had for the loping Gungan were shelved. Lucas would always defend the much-loathed character. He would even suggest at a Disney Expo in 2015 that Binks had been inspired in part by the look and mannerisms of Goofy. "I know that you will look at him differently now," Lucas said with a grin. "I love Goofy, and I love Jar Jar." Fans delighted in theorizing that Lucas's abandoned storyline would have revealed the bumbling comic relief to be a cold-blooded Sith Lord. He would offer only coy silence in response. He had also decided he was indeed done using film and publicly announced that Episode 2 would be filmed entirely digitally. After careful review of the small bit of digital footage he had shot during The Phantom Menace, about 6 minutes worth of lightsaber duels, Lucas was convinced that digital footage would be just as clear and stable as film. In some cases, in fact, it was even clearer, requiring digitally shot footage to be lit differently in order to soften hard edges between objects in the foreground and the background. Making everything look right and work properly required special cameras and lenses, which Sony and Panavision obligingly delivered. There was some hand-wringing in the industry, mostly from those down there in Hollywood, who fretted for the future of filmmaking. One reporter wondered aloud if movies would even be called films anymore. Lucas thought that was taking things too literally. "It will be called cinema," he said reassuringly. There would still be another significant change in the way Lucas made Episode 2. For the first time, production for a Star Wars film wouldn't be based in London, though Lucas still intended to film a few sequences at Elstree. Instead, he had established offices for JAK Productions in Australia at the newly opened Fox Studios in Sydney. So newly opened, in fact, that Episode 2 would be the first major film to shoot there. Once again, Lucas had taken out an extended lease on the entire facility, which would permit him to leave his sets in place during post-production for any additional pickups or new footage. Also, as he had done with The Phantom Menace, Lucas had put nearly every element of pre-production in motion without the benefit of a completed script. Doug Chang and his crew of artists began working on designs for new buildings, spaceships, and planets for Episode 2, based only on Lucas's own enthusiastic descriptions. Lucas would show up at Chang's offices in the main house at Skywalker Ranch to review concepts and models, approving some, rejecting others, and asking for still more ships and cities for any sequences he happened to be writing that particular week. If he liked a drawing's basic concept but thought it needed work, he would stamp OK on it. If he loved a drawing just as it was, he would stamp Fabuloso on it. Over the next 18 months, only 4 drawings would ever receive a Fabuloso. Meanwhile, casting had begun in November 1999, with casting director Robin Gerland searching for actors to play characters who still weren't fleshed out, much beyond brief descriptions on the page. And over in Sydney, Gavin Bouquet and his crew were busily constructing 70 sets or partial sets, even more than had been required for The Phantom Menace. "George had always told us that Episode 2 was going to be much smaller than Phantom Menace," said Bouquet. "But it didn't turn out that way." Everything about Episode 2, in fact, from its budget and sets to its cameras and special effects, would be bigger, fancier, and more high-tech than Episode 1. With shooting scheduled to start in May or June of 2000, Lucas was beginning to feel the pinch of his deadline as 1999 came to an end. He was spending more and more time in his writing room, less with Doug Chang reviewing designs. Later, when the crunch came, I worked on Saturdays as well, writing 4 days a week, said Lucas. But even so, I had to work awfully hard and fast to get all the drafts finished in the amount of time I had. By April 2000, with only a little more than 2 months to go before filming was to begin, Lucas finally called for help, bringing in screenwriter Jonathan Hales, yet another graduate of Young Indiana Jones, and huddling with him out at the ranch to talk through script changes, a process that mostly involved Lucas talking while Hales scribbled notes madly. As Hales went home to London to rewrite the script, Lucas headed for Long Beach to drive in the annual Toyota Pro Celebrity Race. After he had picked the habit up again over the past decade, he hadn't let go. Hales would cut things close, delivering his revised script to Lucas on June 23rd, just as Lucas was leaving for Sydney to begin principal photography. Though cast and crew were already setting up, preparing to start filming, no one had yet a complete copy of the script. With cameras practically ready to roll, Lucas gave Hales's draft a final read, then called the writer in London. "Some of this is brilliant. Some of it is not so brilliant," he told Hales with typical candor. "We'll talk about what's not brilliant." It was a brusque but effective tactic that had worked with Lawrence Kasdan in the 1980s and would work with Hales now. Hales would deliver his final revisions to Sydney shortly thereafter, even as Lucas already had the cameras rolling. Lucas began principal photography on Monday, June 26, 2000, filming actor Ian McDiarmid as the duplicitous Supreme Chancellor Palpatine on Fox's Stage 6, which contained only a podium and an elevated pod. The rest of the soundstage was wrapped entirely in blue screen, onto which ILM would later mat digitally created footage of the enormous Galactic Senate chambers. McDiarmid found it all slightly disorienting. "The script had just arrived at the last minute," recalled McDiarmid. "I was in midair on this pod, there was a camera pointing right at me, and I was addressing crosses and markers rather than real actors." The first appearance of a very real R2-D2, however, had the crew buzzing with excitement. "Everyone goes a bit silly over R2, said Ewan McGregor. There would be similarly deferential excitement for 54-year-old Anthony Daniels, who hadn't worn the full C-3PO costume since completing Return of the Jedi nearly 20 years earlier. On the first day of filming, Daniels snapped on the droid's golden suit, dingy and nearly gray for Episode 2, then slowly shuffled his way across the soundstage toward Lucas. Crew members parted respectfully before him, gaping in awe, some smiling, others waving and calling out, "Hello, 3PO!" Finally, Daniels delicately sauntered up alongside Lucas. "Hello, I am C-3PO," he said in the familiar voice, muffled only slightly by the mask, then extended his hand. "And you are?" "I am astonished," said Lucas with genuine warmth. "Astonished that you can still get into that suit." Lucas loved shooting in the digital high-definition format. With footage going to digital videotape that could then be directly uploaded into a computer for editing, he could see what he'd shot immediately at the end of each day, without having to worry about bad negatives, torn sprocket holes, or underdeveloped film, annoyances that had plagued him on the first Star Wars trilogy. Furthermore, since digital cameras didn't need to be stopped and reloaded with film, which then required more color balance and focus checks, Lucas could essentially point his cameras and shoot, which not only made directing less stressful, but also allowed him to complete more shots each day than with a traditional film camera. "It was vastly superior in every way, and it was cheaper," said Lucas matter-of-factly. "You'd have to be nuts not to shoot this way." The more Lucas played with his digital technology, the more he loved it. Even as he squinted at his sets through the eyepiece of the camera, in fact, he wondered if it might be possible to get by without building any sets at all, shooting his actors solely against blue screen and inserting all the sets digitally later. ILM group supervisor John Knoll talked Lucas off that particular ledge, explaining that it was too difficult at the moment for computer animators to fake the kinds of shadows and reflections created by tangible objects. an argument Lucas accepted, though barely. But director of photography David Tattersall didn't like the technique much either. Blue screen is a necessary, essential part of shooting Star Wars, but it isn't my favorite part, said Tattersall. George is the only one who seems to like it. There's no artistry in lighting blue screen. It is just a technical process. Lucas, however, continued to argue that high-definition filmmaking was more than just a technical trick. In his opinion, it actually forced filmmakers to up their game. Because high definition, by its very nature, often revealed imperfections in sets or makeup, even the smallest blemish or brushstroke would show up on camera. Lucas thought it pushed everyone to work that much harder to make sets, makeup, and costumes convincing. For a perfectionist like Lucas, who agonized over every detail in every frame of film, it was yet another means of ensuring that everything on screen would look exactly the way he wanted it. You couldn't cheat or take shortcuts. The high-def camera would give you away. Lucas's director of photography wasn't the only one tiring of blue screen, however. Lucas's actors, too, were finding it continually bewildering to work with no tangible sets and few real characters. It's a bit like playing chess, and I'm not very good at chess, said McGregor. You do your reactions, and you just hope that the computer-generating guy matches his actions to what you're doing. It's a weird process. 19-year-old Hayden Christensen, who'd been cast as Anakin Skywalker after a year-long search that had included a momentary look at Leonardo DiCaprio, also found blue screen a bit overwhelming at times. Usually we were just in a sea of blue, not really knowing what we were supposed to be looking at, said Christensen. Yet 78-year-old English actor Christopher Lee, who'd done his time in Hammer horror cheapies in the 1960s, had no problem playing against invisible monsters and leaped into his lightsaber battle against a computer-generated Yoda with relish, hacking and slashing away dramatically at the diminutive Jedi Master, who wouldn't be added to the scene for at least another 6 months. The digital Yoda, in fact, was something of a dream come true for Lucas, who'd been frustrated by Yoda's lack of mobility ever since The Empire Strikes Back. With the digital technology now at Lucas's disposal, Yoda was no longer limited to shuffling slowly along the floor at the end of Frank Oz's arm, or being carried on Mark Hamill's back to disguise the fact that Yoda was a puppet. While Oz would still provide Yoda's distinctive voice, he was no longer needed to do the actual performing. Instead, Lucas planned to create Yoda entirely in the computer during post-production, giving him the ability to move around the screen freely. Despite their low-level anxiety about blue screen, Lucas's actors would spend most of the Australian winter, June, July, and August, eagerly chasing one another around empty blue-screened sound stages, leaping into the cockpits of half-completed spaceships, and walking under archways deep in conversation with characters that weren't there. As a director, Lucas was becoming much warmer toward his actors, offering them encouragement and advice beyond simply faster and more intense. Lucas was genuinely fond, as well as a bit protective of, Natalie Portman, who had quietly done much of the heavy lifting on The Phantom Menace as Padme Amidala, the young queen who would eventually give birth to the twins Luke and Leia. Portman had grown up in the years since wrapping The Phantom Menace and was completing her first year at Harvard as production work began on Attack of the Clones. Exhausted from final exams, she fell asleep during her first costume fittings. Lucas was also pleased with his choice of Christensen for the young Anakin Darth Vader, agreeing entirely with McCallum's assessment of the young man. There is something about him that makes you think, yeah, this guy could lose it. Early July saw a visit from an old friend, Francis Ford Coppola, who'd come all the way to Australia mainly just to check on Lucas. The two of them went to dinner together in town, talking movies and families like the old friends they were. And yet, even with more than 30 years of friendship behind them, and by this point Lucas was clearly the more successful of the two, it didn't take long for the pair of them to fall almost unconsciously into the old familiar roles again, with Lucas playing the Padawan to Coppola's Jedi Master. A crew photo taken of Coppola on the set shows Coppola standing at the center of the shot, beaming in a brightly patterned shirt, with his arms folded confidently behind his back, while Lucas stands deferentially off to one side, hands shoved in his pockets. The body language was telling. Old habits tended to die hard, even 30 years later. After filming on the Fox sound stages for several months, Lucas headed for Italy in late August for the first of several location shoots. Normally, location shooting took place before any filming on sound stages, so that the lighting could be matched between exteriors and interiors. With digital filming and editing, however, the lighting could easily be tweaked in the computer to ensure a match. That still didn't make other things easier. Local officials at the Palace of Caserta demanded that Lucas keep all equipment and lighting away from walls and ceilings, making it nearly impossible to provide the needed lighting. After huddling with Tattersall, Lucas opted for a low-tech solution to his high-tech problem by hanging lights from large helium balloons that then floated lazily overhead, giving everything a soft, almost dreamlike glow. Later, as cameras were set up at the Plaza de España in Seville, the one crew member who was mobbed the most for autographs was Lucas himself, who obligingly signed scraps of paper passed to him through the fence surrounding the gigantic Spanish plaza. The last several weeks of shooting would be a sentimental journey for Lucas. In the second week of September, he returned to Tunisia to film on several of the locations where sets constructed for The Phantom Menace were still standing, and in fact were being well maintained by the Tunisian Tourist Board, which rightly saw the sets as a boon to tourism. But after completing a few scenes on the Mos Espa sets, Lucas pushed farther out into the surrounding desert, to the very site where he had constructed the Lars homestead for the original Star Wars. Here, he discovered that construction crews had unearthed and cleaned up several original sets and props that had lain buried in the Tunisian sand since 1976. Other sites, such as the Lars dining room, were intact and occupied by locals, but still remained remarkably unaltered. Lucas looked around in awe. The Star Wars trilogy, and, truth be told, George Lucas and his filmic empire, had been born here in the desert 25 years earlier. It was a very nostalgic experience, he admitted. Lucas would wrap up principal photography on September 20th at another nostalgic location, Elstree Studios in London. Each of the first three Star Wars movies had been filmed here beginning in 1976, but Lucas hadn't been back since completing Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade in 1988. Here on Elstree's familiar soundstage, he would film Ewan McGregor clinging to a flying assassin droid as a wind machine whipped at him furiously. And with that, filming was over. Lucas had completed principal photography in 60 days, a day and a half ahead of schedule. He immediately headed for Skywalker Ranch, where Ben Burtt was already waiting with a rough cut of the movie, and Lucas could hardly wait to get his hands on it. "My heart is actually in the editing room," he said. For Lucas, the fun part was about to begin. "I never thought I'd do the Star Wars prequels because there was no real way I could get Yoda to fight," Lucas said later. "But once you had digital, there was no end to what you could do." That way of thinking was actually somewhat worrisome to the crew at ILM, who knew that Lucas expected them to keep pushing the boundaries of eye-popping digital effects. Lucas, in fact, had spooked visual effects supervisor John Knoll by informing him that he had held back on the number of special effects he wanted to do in The Phantom Menace, "because I wasn't sure you guys at ILM could do it." Knoll assured Lucas that ILM would get the job done, but privately conceded, "That was a scary thing to hear, especially considering that Phantom Menace had required more than 2,000 effect shots." No other digital effect was more important, perhaps, than creating a convincing Yoda. It fell to animator Rob Coleman to oversee the team that would spark to digital life one of Star Wars' most beloved characters, who many fans thought was already lifelike enough in the hands of Frank Oz and shouldn't be messed with. Coleman understood exactly what was at stake. "On episode 2, I was stressing about living up to what Frank Oz had created," Coleman reflected later. "I went back and studied what Frank Oz had done frame by frame." Even then, once Lucas had decided that Yoda would engage in a high-energy lightsaber duel, indicated in the script only with the stage direction Yoda attacks. Both he and Coleman knew it was important not to make the diminutive Jedi look silly. It was one of those situations where we set ourselves an impossible task and then just hoped we could accomplish it, said Lucas. Coleman would end up creating a physical yet graceful Yoda, who swooped and darted deftly as he battled Count Dooku in what would become one of the movie's most memorable and talked-about sequences. Lucas also had ILM working on a chase through the skies of Coruscant, with Anakin speeding through the city in what was essentially a flying hot rod with an exposed engine in the front, much like Lucas's old Fiat Bianchina. It was even yellow, yet another in a long line of yellow Lucas race cars. This sequence, too, would be created almost entirely in the computer, closely adhering to the animatics that Burt and ILM effects supervisor David Dozeretz had cut into the first rough edit. Most of the stormtroopers would also be entirely digital, finally giving Lucas the battalions of armored fighters that his limited number of stormtrooper costumes would never have permitted him to include in the original trilogy. Even better from Lucas's perspective, digital technology continued to give him complete control over every element on the screen, permitting him to remove actors from one scene and insert them into another, or to change the background setting of an entire sequence with the click of a mouse. And because both the movie and the special effects had all been created digitally, there was no need to transfer special effects over to film before cutting them into the movie itself, resulting in a loss of image quality. Effects in the finished movie would look almost exactly the way ILM had produced them with the computer. Lucas and Burt screened their first full cut of the movie in February 2001, assessing where cuts could be made to pick up the pace. The first edit was nearly 3 hours long, and to eliminate scenes that were redundant or unnecessary, or simply didn't work. Just as important, Lucas could also see where pieces of his story might be missing, where a new scene might be needed to fill in a hole in the plot, or new conversations were needed to convey necessary information to the audience. Several times throughout 2001, Lucas went back and wrote new scenes, calling his actors back to the studio to complete a series of pickups. While Lucas had maintained his sets at Fox Sydney, he saw no need at this point ever to shoot on a set again. Instead, he would shoot all of the new footage at Ealing Studios in West London, on a small soundstage swathed entirely in blue screen. Everything else could be added later. Star Wars had become a truly digital universe. There were nearly 400,000 Jedi Knights in England. That, at least, would be the official word from the Census Office of the United Kingdom, following results of the country's 2001 census, in which just over 390,000 of 52 million residents of England and Wales wrote Jedi in the blank on their census form asking for their religion. An online campaign claimed that if enough residents wrote in Jedi, it would be formally recognized as a religion by the British government. And while that wasn't actually true, census officials credited a boost in return forms from younger residents to their desire to see Jedi receive an official government designation. In the end, enough fans had written in Jedi to make it the fourth largest religion in the United Kingdom, a phenomenon the Census Office recognized in a press release under a cheeky headline mimicking Yoda's distinctive speaking pattern, 390,000 Jedi there are. As for Lucas, his own religious views had both mellowed and sharpened with age. "I'm a cynical optimist," he told Time magazine, laughing. "I'm a cynic who has hope for the human race." There were times when it would be easier to be more cynical than hopeful. In August 2001, Lucas revealed on StarWars.com that the title of Episode 2 would be Attack of the Clones, an announcement that met with near-audible groans and laughter from critics and fans. The official line from Lucasfilm was that the title harkened back to the sense of pure fun, imagination, and excitement of the pulpy serials that had inspired Star Wars. Critics were having none of it. "When you're managing a multi-billion dollar toy franchise," jeered Entertainment Weekly, "maybe you don't have time to come up with cool titles." Things would improve in October with the release of The Phantom Menace on DVD, the first Star Wars movie to be released in the new digital format. Lucas had pulled out all the stops for the double disc set, instructing ILM to complete the special effects on deleted scenes and package them as part of the disc's many bonus features. The DVD would take in a record-setting $45 million in its first week of release. Despite the thrashing the film had taken from fans and critics, everyone still wanted to take it home. Still, for Attack of the Clones, Lucas was going to scale back the merchandising significantly. Lucasfilm's marketing executives conceded that Episode 1 had been over-licensed, over-shipped, and oversaturated, and announced they were cutting merchandising by nearly two-thirds. There would be no neckties, no fast food tie-ins, and, to the likely relief of Pepsi, which had circulated nearly 8 billion cans of soda featuring Episode 1 characters with little to show for it, no official soft drink. As he had done with Episode 1, Lucas would tightly and dramatically coordinate the promotion for Episode 2, hiding one trailer on the StarWars.com website that could be accessed only by inserting a Phantom Menace DVD into a home computer. Lucas would also debut a full-length trailer in November in front of the highly anticipated Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Lucas had deliberately played up the love story between Anakin and Padme, a decision that left some fans cold. Furthermore, after all the hype and excitement that had surrounded the trailers for Episode 1, and then the relative disappointment of the film itself, many fans were refusing to get fooled again. Lucas attempted some damage control by inviting webmasters of Star Wars websites, especially those who oversaw sites where he had taken a beating on Episode 1, out to Skywalker Ranch, ostensibly to discuss the release of Episode 1 on DVD, but actually to win them over well in advance of the release of Episode 2. The webmasters were given a tour of the ranch, autographed copies of the Episode 1 DVD, and 20 minutes to pepper Lucas with questions. But goodwill would only go so far. This time, fan excitement would be tinged with skepticism. Lucas had turned his own fans into cynical optimists. As the May 2002 release date approached for Attack of the Clones, Lucas was spending more time at ILM, screening dailies twice a week now instead of only once. Lucas would sit in the same place every time he entered the ILM theater, still always taking the center seat in the second row. In one corner of the theater stood a full-sized R2-D2 next to a totem pole listing all of the films for which ILM had received an Oscar nomination for Best Visual Effects. With more effects companies embracing the digital technology ILM had pioneered, competition was getting tighter each year, and ILM hadn't produced an Oscar winner since taking home the trophy in 1995 for Forrest Gump. Since then, they'd continued to receive a nomination each year, Mighty Joe Young in 1999, The Phantom Menace in 2000, it had lost to the game-changing, time-stopping effects in The Matrix, and the most recent film on the poll, The Perfect Storm, which would lose the Oscar in 2001 to Gladiator. Lucas would continue to edit the film even from his seat in the second row, asking that characters be moved from one scene to another, blending together different takes of the same scene, or zooming in on a particular section of the frame. On April 8, 2002, only a little more than a month before Attack of the Clones would open, Lucas signed off on the final effects shot. Days later, he met with the art department again to ask them to start thinking about designs for Episode 3, once more without benefit of a script or even any notes. Really, the only set he could describe at the moment was the volcano world where Anakin Skywalker would be cut down and Darth Vader would rise from the ashes. Lucas had loved the concept drawings of Vader's castle on a sea of lava that Ralph McQuarrie had done for him more than two decades earlier, during pre-production on The Empire Strikes Back. He wanted to see that in the next film, or at least something like it. "We never truly know what George is doing," lamented McCallum. Ben Burtt put a final edit of Attack of the Clones in Lucas's hands on April 10th, and Lucas would host a special preview for staff and crew at Skywalker Ranch's 300-seat Stag Theater. But there would be no film spooled onto enormous reels and placed on a projector. Because the entire movie had been put together digitally, Attack of the Clones could be stored on a DVD and shown with a digital projector. That, at least, was the ideal scenario. At the moment, most theaters still relied on film projectors, so for the majority of theaters showing Episode 2, Lucas would have to scan the digital version of his movie back onto film, an expensive process that would also result in a loss of picture quality. Nevertheless, just as he had encouraged cinema owners in the mid-1980s to install new speakers and reconfigure their theaters for THX by promising them Return of the Jedi, now he would spur them toward digital technology simply by assuring them that such technology was the wave of the future. They could evolve and show films like Attack of the Clones, or slowly go extinct. Most chose to evolve. Studios and cinemas alike would follow Lucas's lead. Studios would begin distributing movies both digitally and on film, while theaters would begin slowly converting to digital projection systems. As Lucas prepared to release Attack of the Clones in 2002, only about 30 theaters in the world could accommodate digital films. The technology was expensive. Digital projection systems would cost a theater about $100,000, 10 times more than the traditional 35mm projectors. But studios like Paramount, which by 2014 would be the first to distribute its films entirely in a digital format, worked with theaters to finance the conversion to digital systems, and by 2014, 92% of the 40,045 screens in the United States would have digital capability. And Lucas had led the charge, clenching a DVD of Attack of the Clones in his upraised fist. Attack of the Clones was released on May 16, 2002, in 3,161 theaters. It would reap $110.2 million in its first 4 days, on its way to a worldwide gross of $649 million by the end of the year. A staggering number, to be sure, but well short of Phantom Menace, and only enough to make it the fourth highest-grossing film of the year. The film may not have set a record, but it was wildly profitable. A box office success that was not merely inevitable, thought New York Times critic A.O. Scott, but downright predictable. After all, everyone was going to see Star Wars. Like weary Brezhnev-era Muscovites, the American movie-going public will line up out of habit and compulsion, wrote Scott, ruefully hoping that this episode will at least be a little better than the last one. And indeed, some critics were kinder to Episode 2, with Rolling Stone applauding it for being crammed with action, grand digital design, and a dark side Lucas hasn't flaunted since 1980's The Empire Strikes Back. Nearly every review praised the digital effects, though Episode 2 would ultimately lose the Oscar to director Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings: The Two Towers, the middle part of another epic trilogy that was unfurling on movie screens at the same time as Lucas's prequels. Roger Ebert spent a lot of time on the digital technology in his review for the Chicago Sun-Times, complaining that the images were often indistinct, which he blamed, to Lucas's likely delight, on the fact that his local theater lacked the digital projection system that Lucas favored. But beyond the special effects, most critics found the film unremarkable, even boring. A trait Ebert blamed on Lucas's dialogue-heavy script. "They talk and talk and talk," Ebert complained, a gripe that Peter Travers seconded, adding snarkily, "Lucas still can't write dialogue that doesn't induce projectile vomiting." David Anson, writing in Newsweek under a headline reading "Attack of the Groans," complained bitterly about nearly everything, from the script to the digital effects to the wooden acting, which Anson also blamed on Lucas's screenwriting. "Yes, it's better than The Phantom Menace," Anson conceded. "No, it's not great." Lucas was typically dismissive of the criticism. Anything the critics didn't like, clunky dialogue, over-the-top extended battle sequences, Lucas claimed had been done intentionally. And what about those eye-rolling love scenes that the New York Times had called the most embarrassing romantic avowals in recent screen history? "I was very happy with the way it turned out in the script and in the performances, but I knew people might not buy it," he said defiantly. "It is presented very honestly. It isn't tongue-in-cheek at all, and it's really played to the hilt. This film is even more of a melodrama than the others." He had done it all on purpose, he claimed. One critic at the Los Angeles Times wasn't buying it. In a scathing article headlined, "Seclusion Has Left Lucas Out of Touch," critic Patrick Goldstein argued that one of Lucas's biggest problems as a filmmaker was that there was no one in his organization who would tell him that intentional melodrama was a bad idea. "No one seems to deliver bad news," wrote Goldstein. "Lucas's best work was made with strong collaborators. His talents are probably better suited as a conceptual thinker and producer than director." Lucas bristled at the very suggestion that he needed collaborators rather than subordinates. "That's one of the problems of a democracy. You get these individual voices that are very loud and very dysfunctional," he sighed. "And if you cater to those voices, you end up with a very dysfunctional society. The solution: create, oversee, control everything." The cramped attic space of Skywalker Ranch's main house had been converted into a makeshift art department. Artists' tables butted up against one another, and piles of art books and journals teetered on low tables. Space was tight, artists worked practically elbow to elbow, and some wore earphones to listen to music privately as they sketched. Some of the more gadget-savvy even had the new Apple iPod on their table, white earbuds dangling. It was here, under the eaves, that Lucas had installed his concept artists to begin work on designs for Episode 3. Lucas would stroll the room, stepping past a bathroom door with a sign reading, "Dooku's Throne Room," hanging on it, peering over his shoulders or spreading drawings out on the side tables. As usual, the artists were flying without a net. It was June 2002, a month after the release of Attack of the Clones, and Lucas hadn't written a word of the new screenplay yet. McCallum, once more tasked with watching the bottom line, grimly compared Lucas's creative process to building backward, designing a 25-floor skyscraper without foundations, then sighed gustily. "Do you know what it's like to budget a film without a script?" But Lucas wasn't going to be rushed. The script for Episode 3 would be critical. Not only did he have to finish telling the story of Anakin Skywalker's descent into the dark side, but also he had to make sure that Episode 3 logically led back to the original Star Wars. "I've painted myself into a corner," he said, using a metaphor his artists could understand. "I have to get from there to here, and I have to connect these two things, the original trilogy and the prequels, in a very precise way. Writing is a lot of puzzle solving." But even as pencils flew and McCallum fretted, Lucas left for Canada with his children for vacation. While on vacation, he'd jot down ideas for Episode 3, as well as for another film he was hoping to put into production soon, and which as yet had only a working title, Indiana Jones 4. It would take Lucas a long time to really begin writing Episode 3, and with each passing day, artists and designers became more and more anxious. In a November 1st meeting with McCallum and Rob Coleman, who would again be animating Yoda, Lucas casually mentioned that he'd start writing when reality hits. McCallum was stunned. "You said you've been writing," he said gently. Lucas waved him off. "I've been thinking about it," said Lucas. 3 weeks later, Lucas met with designers to review drawings of planets and a few characters. "Keep up the good work. The stuff was great, guys," he told them as he left the room. "I just have to figure out a movie to go with it." By mid-December, he'd finally forced himself to sit at the desk in his office for 4 days a week, trying to get anything at all down on the page. McCallum would beg Lucas for tidbits of information about sets, any information he could convey to the crew at Fox Studios in Sydney, where carpenters anxiously hung on any word from Lucas about what a particular set should look like. Lucas continued writing through the Christmas and New Year's holidays, scrawling his draft in pencil on lined paper as always. "This is all subject to change," he insisted as he reviewed with designer Gavin Bouquet a list of sets and characters, including a 10-year-old Han Solo, whom Lucas envisioned working with Yoda to track down the villainous General Grievous. Lucas finally completed his 55-page rough draft, already titled Revenge of the Sith, a nod to his abandoned title for Return of the Jedi, on January 31, 2003. Even then, only McCallum was given the completed draft. Rather than hand over a script to the design crew, Lucas preferred to describe the look of the sets personally to Bouquet and his team. "So they know what's going on and can plan," he told McCallum. "But not enough information so they can lock something down, because everything is going to change." And then back he went into his writing room to work on the next draft. McCallum, more amused now than annoyed, left for Sydney to confer with production heads about the sets and props they would begin building, based on a script they still weren't permitted to read. It's likely, too, that Lucas's focus was elsewhere, at least in the early part of 2003. On Saturday, February 8th, with San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi beside him, Lucas presided over the official groundbreaking for his digital art center on the grounds of the Presidio. It had taken longer than he had hoped for the day to arrive. The official agreement with the Presidio Trust hadn't been signed until August 2001, nearly 2 years after the deal was announced. Even then, work had stalled for yet another 2 years, but Lucas was determined that the $300 million project would now proceed quickly and smoothly, shooting for a grand opening sometime in 2005. But this time, the work would proceed without him. While Lucas had presided over nearly every element of the design and construction of Skywalker Ranch, Lucasfilm CFO Micheline Chow, who was on her way to replacing Gordon Radley as president and COO, politely but firmly informed Lucas that he couldn't visit the Presidio site unless he was invited. As Chow delicately put it, "George and I had a conversation about freedom and letting go." Over the next year and a half, Lucas would be invited to the site only 3 times, which was just long enough for him to obsessively review 20 different window designs and more than 100 fabric swatches for the walls of the movie theater. Chow's directive probably kept work on Revenge of the Sith on track. With the Presidio facility unavailable to him, Lucas had to go back to his desk each day, writing from 8:30 a.m. until 6 p.m. Even after 40 years of writing scripts, it hadn't gotten any easier. "I can be chained to my desk and I still can't write it. But I do it, you know," he added proudly. "I do get it done." On April 10th, a group of designers came into his office to find him sitting at his desk, pencil down, head bowed. "I just finished the first full draft," he told them. He would start the second draft immediately. Filming at Fox Sydney was scheduled to begin in 2 months. On the morning of May 1st, Lucas walked into the art department and threw the recently completed script down on a table. Even at 10 in the morning, he already looked tired. "Next week, I'm bringing in a guest director so I don't have to do this anymore," he told his artists calmly. "I've done pretty much everything I can do. The director's coming in on Thursday, so I want to go through all this." And here, he gestured to all the art plastered on the walls and scattered across the tables. "And show him everything that's here." Nervous glances were exchanged. Concept design supervisor Ryan Church remembered wondering if he would need to move back to Hollywood to look for work. For the next week, the ranch was buzzing with excitement and nervousness, everyone speculating on the identity of the mysterious director. On Thursday, May 8th, Lucas introduced his guest director to the crew, Steven Spielberg. Spielberg, however, wasn't coming on board to direct the film. Instead, Lucas had invited him to participate in the editing of some of the extensive animatics Ben Burtt had prepared for a number of key sequences. "I said to Steven, 'We'll give you a laptop and we'll give you the program, and I'll give you some scenes,' said Lucas. 'And you can direct the scenes while you're just sitting by the pool.' He loves to do that." Spielberg would tinker mostly with the climactic lightsaber duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan on the volcano planet Mustafar. "I want these guys pouring, dripping sweat," Spielberg told Lucas excitedly. "Their hair at some point should be smoking." Lucas loved it. "We have very, very similar sensibilities," he said. With filming scheduled to begin at Fox Studios in Sydney at the end of June, Lucas arrived in Australia on June 15th, bringing along the third draft of his script, which he was still revising. He also brought his children. Revenge of the Sith would be something of a family affair for the Lucases, with all three kids and Lucas too making cameo appearances in the film. Lucas would make his screen debut as the blue-faced Baron Papanoida, walking outside a theater box at the Opera House with 15-year-old Katie, also in blueface, as his daughter. Amanda, now 22, would be seen huddling with senators while 10-year-old Jet, who had played a Jedi youngling named Zet Jukasa in Attack of the Clones, reprised the role for Episode 3, doing some very minor stunts as he flipped and battled stormtroopers with a lightsaber and, to his delight, would even get to die heroically on screen. Lucas completed the fourth and final draft of Revenge of the Sith in Sydney on June 26th. 4 days later, he began filming on Stage 2 at Fox Studios. Bouquet and his team had constructed 71 sets this time, about as many as he had for Episode 2, in an attempt to help Lucas keep his promise that Episode 3 would be smaller and less expensive than the film before it. It was, though just barely. Lucas would top out his budget for Revenge of the Sith at $113 million, compared to the $120 million he'd spent on Attack of the Clones. He was shooting entirely digitally again, which gave him the ability to review a shot instantly on the numerous high-def plasma screens he'd set up in what came to be called the Video Village, a small camp of folding chairs, video monitors, and equipment set up on the soundstage. Here, Lucas could see every camera angle at once, displayed across the various monitors, then select the shots he wanted and transmit them immediately to Bert at Skywalker Ranch for editing. Lucas also used the village as a kind of home base, holding court as he reviewed the shooting schedule each morning, tweaked the script, huddled with actors, or oversaw a costume adjustment. While Lucas consulted regularly with McCallum and other crew members, the final decision on anything was his and his alone. McCallum understood perfectly. "Film is a director's medium. Television is a producer's medium," said McCallum. "Working with George is a George medium." Lucas didn't disagree. "I guess I've been accused of being a micromanager, but as far as I'm concerned, that's what making a movie is all about," he said. "I'm really responsible for every single detail on the picture." On July 2nd, Anthony Daniels, once again reprising his role as 3PO, made his first appearance on set, picking his way around cables in his gleaming gold costume. Lucas shook his hand warmly, calling out loudly, "Star Wars has arrived." The same could probably have been said of the amiable Peter Mayhew, whose appearance in the full Chewbacca costume was met with audible gasps as he loped his way across the soundstage. Actor Ewan McGregor admitted to being starstruck, even getting a bit emotional as he shot a final scene with R2-D2 in August. "I find myself quite choked up about it, about this little robot, you know." Lucas was continuing to improve his interactions with his actors, more often telling them when takes were good, and giving them actual directions on the delivery of lines or the pacing of a scene. And yet, some habits were hard to break. During one particularly difficult scene requiring multiple takes, even as his actors asked for a moment to collect themselves, Lucas could be heard muttering, "Oh, I just want to get through it." Still, it was better than the days of faster and more intense. If asked, Lucas would probably admit that he had mellowed a bit over the past 30 years. Partly it had to do with age. His beard was white now, though it would always be meticulously trimmed. His hair, by contrast, could sometimes get long, and he would comb it back a bit into his pompadour, now wavy and white. The intensity and stubbornness were still there too, but Lucas found he could relax more on the set, a change he had attributed mostly to the presence of his children, who ensured that he never took himself too seriously. Children, and teenagers in particular, he joked, were the key to a nervous breakdown. By the time principal photography was completed on September 17th, 5 days ahead of schedule, Lucas would even call Revenge of the Sith the most fun film I've ever worked on. Still, he wasn't going to get too sentimental. As some crew members hugged or dabbed at their eyes as they bade one another goodbye, Lucas remained remarkably unemotional. Fleeting friendships were simply part of movie making. You're all friends. You know each other, he explained. But I have a tendency not to let my private life and my professional life mix, and once the movie finishes, everybody goes their own way. When you're together, and when you're not, you're not. And besides, for Lucas, it was still far too early to celebrate. Revenge of the Sith wasn't even close to being finished. As crew members passed around congratulatory drinks, Lucas pulled aside ILM's John Knoll, who would oversee much of the post-production work. I've been working on it for 18 months, he told Knoll, and I have exactly 18 months to go. Special effects work at ILM was proceeding at a slower pace than Lucas hoped, so he enacted the only solution he understood. He hovered over people, dropping in daily to review footage while he ate his lunch, a sandwich and a soda in a to-go box prepared by the downstairs kitchen. Other times, Lucas would plant himself at an animation station, watching as the computer animator moved elements in and out of frame and offering suggestions on different angles from which to film the sequence. In December, Lucas invited Coppola to the ranch to observe firsthand how the digital process worked. After Coppola's earlier failed experiments with technology, Lucas wanted his mentor to see how it could be done right. Coppola, looking dapper in a gray suit, watched with fascination as Lucas demonstrated his ability to direct the movie digitally, moving characters out of one scene and into another, raising a character's arm, even inserting a blink. Typically, Coppola was concerned about the impact such spontaneous editing might have on the story. Are you changing the script much? He asked Lucas, or is it holding up pretty well? Lucas considered for a moment. It's holding up. Coppola nodded, then looked around the editing room approvingly. You're doing what you like to do most, he told Lucas warmly. Having fun. As Lucas continued the editing, he made notes for several pickup shots and additional footage. While the script was holding up, there were places where clarification was needed, and Lucas had scheduled time for additional filming at Shepperton in London for late August 2004, his first time back at the studio since filming the throne room ceremony for the first Star Wars film 25 years earlier. It was here Lucas would film a final shot of Anthony Daniels dressed as 3PO. Even with the improvements built into the costume over the past two decades, it was still difficult for Daniels to hear much, and Lucas stood by patiently for several takes until Daniels finally got his lines right and hit his marks. Lucas called, "Cut!" and flashed a thumbs up to Daniels, who felt as if he had been repeatedly and patiently incarcerated inside 3PO's shell for decades. It's only been 25 years, Lucas told Daniels kindly. And we're still not getting it right, teased Daniels. Thank you, Lucas said, as the two men shook hands. Thank you for everything. Lucas had plenty of other nooks and crannies of the Star Wars universe to attend to in the months leading up to the release of Revenge of the Sith. In September 2004, he'd released the original trilogy on DVD for the first time, and typically couldn't keep his hands off it, inserting several new tweaks to the films he'd already modified. During filming on Episode 3, he'd taken the opportunity to record Ian McDiarmid reading the Emperor's dialogue from The Empire Strikes Back, which had been made several years before McDiarmid had even been cast in the role, and dubbed his voice over the original dialogue, thus ensuring consistency with the prequels. Curiously, he also digitally removed actor Sebastian Shaw from the final scene in Jedi, where the redeemed Anakin materializes to join Yoda and Ben Kenobi at Luke's side, and replaced him with Hayden Christensen. He had been only half-joking when he suggested to ILM that they insert Liam Neeson's Qui-Gon Jinn into the scene as well. While fans would continue to gripe about Lucas's changes, and the Han shot first movement would rumble back to life again, especially as many home viewers were seeing all of Lucas's tweaks to their beloved films for the first time, they would still buy anything Star Wars, spending more than $100 million for the DVDs on their first day of their release. A year earlier, starting in November 2003, he'd also begun managing at arm's length a successful animated micro-series, 25 episodes running from 3 to 12 minutes each, called Star Wars Clone Wars, which followed Obi-Wan and Anakin on adventures occurring between episodes 2 and 3. It was Lucas's intention to use the cartoon to bridge the gap between the two movies, and he had provided director and animator Genndy Tartakovsky, the creator of Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack, with a storyline and ground rules, then left him largely alone. Lucas had been so pleased with the resulting cartoons, which were fast, witty, and exciting, that he permitted Tartakovsky to introduce one of Revenge of the Sith's villains, General Grievous, in a March 2005 episode, 2 months before the premiere of Episode 3. By the time the episode aired on the Cartoon Network on March 25th, fans were already lining up for Revenge of the Sith. In Seattle, one young fan had set up an elaborate camp with a powder blue couch at its center. From here, he would post daily live updates to his blog until he was evicted by the mayor for camping on public property. He was later relocated to a private sidewalk outside another theater. In Los Angeles, Star Wars lovers lined up outside a theater where the movie wouldn't even be playing, hoping to persuade Fox to premiere the film at Grauman's Chinese Theater. The ploy didn't work, but fans had a great time anyway, staging lightsaber fights, raising money for charity, and maintaining a genial party atmosphere. Nerdy Gross, one fan called it. Lucas and McCallum attended the May 16th premiere of Revenge of the Sith at the UCI Empire Theater in London, which showed the movie as the final installment of a 6-film Star Wars marathon. Lucas had been concerned that people might find the movie too downbeat. The violence, in fact, had earned Revenge of the Sith the first PG-13 rating for a Star Wars film. "It's not a happy movie by any stretch of the imagination," Lucas admitted. "It's a tragedy. It will probably be the least successful of the Star Wars movies, but I know that." He was wrong. Revenge of the Sith set a single-day record of $50 million on its way to an opening weekend of $108 million and a worldwide gross of $848 million. Furthermore, the movie's darker themes didn't seem to turn off fans or critics at all. In fact, many thought Lucas had returned to form. A.O. Scott, who had eviscerated episodes 1 and 2 in the New York Times, thought episode 3 was not only the best of the prequels, but also even better than the original Star Wars. The critic for Variety, too, thought Lucas had redeemed himself after the disappointment of the first two movies, declaring that, despite fans' varying degrees of loss of faith that set in with Menace and Clones, most will be inspired enough to believe again. Over at Newsweek, David Anson compared the film favorably with The Empire Strikes Back and applauded Lucas himself for his artistic consistency. For all the technological changes Lucas has embraced, his wide-eyed, childlike approach to storytelling has remained the same, wrote Anson. "You can argue whether it's for better or worse. What you can't argue with is that he's stayed true to his vision and that that vision has changed the cultural landscape irrevocably." Still, even Anson and Scott noted they had also had to put up with Lucas's usual bad dialogue, as well as the complete lack of chemistry between the two romantic leads, and way too much digital showing off. Though everyone, as always, loved Yoda, a testament to the animation skills of Rob Coleman. Lucas was delighted with the response to Revenge of the Sith, but he was even more thrilled to finally cut the ribbon at the grand opening of his Digital Arts Center at the Presidio in June. The compound was officially designated the Letterman Digital Arts Center for the Letterman Army Hospital that had stood on the site since 1898. Architects had even designed some of the buildings to use the recycled remains of the hospital, blending the Presidio's unique history into the center's very DNA. The 23-acre campus featured 4 5-story buildings made of brick and terracotta, totaling about 850,000 square feet, and all of it financed solely by Lucasfilm to the tune of $350 million. Here, among Japanese maples and weeping willow trees, and with views of the Golden Gate Bridge and the Palace of Fine Arts, Lucas would relocate ILM, THX, LucasArts, the George Lucas Educational Foundation, and the headquarters of Lucasfilm, about 2,500 employees in total. While Lucas hadn't gotten ILM to the ranch, he had finally brought the ILMers into the fold, not only providing them with the best equipment and a state-of-the-art facility, but also putting them where they could easily interact and collaborate with their counterparts at THX and LucasArts, two of the company's most profitable subsidiaries. As he had done by hiding ILM in plain sight at the Kerner building, Lucas would give little indication at the Letterman compound of what was really going on inside each of the four rather prim-looking buildings. The only giveaway was a bronze statue of Yoda near the front entrance. After 25 years of gawking at Skywalker Ranch in the hills of Nicasio and aching to get in, the public, for the first time, was welcome to take a look inside a Lucasfilm compound, even if it was just the smallest of peaks. Visitors would be permitted into the lobby of Building B, where they could see Star Wars props and other memorabilia, including life-size replicas of Darth Vader and Boba Fett, and proving once and for all that Lucas wasn't above poking a little fun at himself, there stood off to one side an immense carbonite block encasing not an anguished Han Solo, but a rather tongue-lolling Jar Jar Binks. Lucasfilm president Michelin Chow thought the company's very public presence in the San Francisco community was good for Lucasfilm and good for the region, especially since declining revenues had recently forced both Coppola and producer Saul Zantz to shutter their own studios in the area. "We spent a lot of years hidden away, and I'm not sure it was good for the company as a whole," said Chow. "The world has changed. To be the epicenter of the digital revolution, we have to be out here, evangelizing the cause." There was also speculation that the company's higher profile meant that Lucas was preparing to take the company public, a rumor Chow quashed immediately. There would only ever be one stockholder at Lucasfilm, George Lucas. On the evening of June 9, 2005, Lucas donned a rare tuxedo to receive the American Film Institute's Life Achievement Award, given annually to an individual whose career has contributed to the enrichment of American culture. In the eyes of many, it was a long time coming. Harrison Ford had received the same award in 2000, and Spielberg had been a recipient in 1995. Whether one enjoyed Lucas's films or not, it was impossible to deny that he'd enriched American culture. Over the past three decades, he'd practically created it, whether via major technological and merchandising innovations or just the characters and stories of his movies themselves. While Lucas was generally disdainful of awards, he seemed genuinely touched by the pomp and circumstance surrounding this one. After a heartfelt introduction by Spielberg, "You have done more for the collective consciousness of this planet than you will ever know," Lucas took the stage to a thunderous standing ovation, then hoisted the award victoriously over his head for a moment. He thanked the crowd warmly. "I halfway expected to have a room full of stormtroopers and Princess Leia's," he joked, getting his first of many laughs, and bowed to Spielberg as "my partner, my pal, my inspiration, and my challenger." He gave high praise to Coppola for giving him his start. "He never gave up on me," Lucas said fondly. "He took me from not being able to write a word to being the king of wooden dialogue," a line at which Harrison Ford laughed harder than anyone else. His biggest thanks, however, were reserved for his children, "who have made my life extra special." Amanda and Katie, seated next to Spielberg, wept openly. "I love cinema," Lucas concluded. "All kinds, no matter how big, no matter how small. I love to watch them. I love to make them. But if I didn't have anyone to enjoy them or appreciate them, there wouldn't be any point. So, thank you all for going to the movies," he said warmly. "Especially mine." And they would keep going to the movies, especially his, all summer long. Revenge of the Sith would finish the year as the highest-grossing film in the United States for 2005, and the third-highest-grossing of the six Star Wars films. It was also the culmination of two trilogies that had taken up more than 30 years of Lucas's life. "He was happy and relieved to be done with the series," he told a local reporter, "and now that it was over, especially now that he had the new digital playground at the Presidio at his disposal, he was ready to move on. I'm going to do other types of projects, he told American Cinematographer. Things that I've wanted to do for a long time. Definitely a very different kind of filmmaking than what I've been engaged in. There would be esoteric art films, he said, and maybe even another Indiana Jones movie. But of one thing he was certain, there would be no more Star Wars. Star Wars is finished, Lucas said. I do have a lot of other movies that I want to make. I don't have to answer to anybody. That's what I've earned. To be able to do what I want to do.